This is All the Best on FBI Radio 94.5. My name is Jesse Cox. I'm one of the producers on the show, and I'm introducing an episode from our archive, from our vault. We made it last year when a bunch of producers hung out at the block in Redfern, in meeting the residents, interviewing them at the church, at the local gym, the people who lived in the houses, while the debate raged about whether or not those houses should be demolished to make way for the Pemulwuy project. Well, since we broadcast these stories, those last houses have been knocked down, so we thought it was a fitting time to relive this feature all about the block.
Police say they smashed a drug ring in Redfern. Seven people have been arrested after synchronized raids on two...
Out of our door.
Last weekend, my mum was bashed and robbed.
But nothing to prove. It is getting worse.
In a community they call the block, that 17-year-old Thomas Hickey fell from his bike yesterday.
Unite in Australia's biggest city is a major setback for race relations.
His family and members of the Aboriginal community point the finger at Boris.
This is the block you might know, a place of riots, drugs, and violence. The words the block have taken on an almost metaphorical significance in the media, so much so that it's easy to forget that the block is an actual address. It's had a rough history, sure, but like any community, it also held stories of friendship, faith, and redemption. This is All the Best. My name's Eliza Salos, and today we're spending our whole show in and around the block in Redfern. Before we begin the show, I would like to acknowledge and pay respect to the traditional owners of the land on which our story is set, the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. It is upon their ancestral lands that our story takes place. Today we'll walk the streets of the block and trace through lines of family and memory. You'll hear stories of this community from the perspectives of those who are part of it. Let's begin by heading to one of the main streets that make up the block. In this story, we meet Yvonne Phillips. She grew up in Redfern and raised her family at No. 5 Vine Street.
Well, my family used to live up there. Everly Street, Central Street, Glosson Street, Hugo Street, Lewis Street. Well, it's been all my life around here.
The voice you are hearing belongs to Yvonne. She is a 70-year-old Gadigal woman of the Eora Nation, and up until 2 weeks ago, she lived with her husband at No. 5 Vine Street, Redfern.
A lot of people say they're Eora, but it's not true, you know. But I got about five or six generations out at La Perouse buried there, and I never known anything but Redfern and La Perouse.
Yvonne's story is a domestic one, of home, family and belonging. She's telling us this story around the kitchen table in her new house in Waterloo, and it's fitting then that the sound you can hear underneath her voice is one of the most domestic sounds of them all, the washing machine. Yvonne has lived in Redfern since she was born, and she can still clearly remember the days when milk and bread were delivered by horse and cart. Back in those days, her family never lived in the one house for long.
We always got moved around. You couldn't get houses because you couldn't get jobs. My mum used to do ironing for people and go wash their clothes, you know, do things like that to earn some money.
This was in the years before any government assistance, and Yvonne's family found it quite hard to make ends meet. In the mid-1940s, when Yvonne was 4 or 5, her family moved away from Redfern and settled into the Aboriginal community at La Perouse. She remembers her house-proud mum whitewashing the walls of their new home.
When we moved out there, it was beautiful, really. It was about the happiest I think I ever spent my childhood at La Perouse. I was only little, but, you know, but I liked it because we could go swimming, you know.
But a year or so after they settled in, the peace and stability that Yvonne and her family had created in La Perouse was shattered by a change in government policy.
And anyway, this government comes out and they say we have to move. Shifted us all out. While we're still there, I can just remember it. They bulldozed the place down. And I could say, I would say to Mum, what are we going to do, Mum? Where are we going to stay? She's just sitting there crying.
Yvonne was 5 or 6 by this point. Her parents moved the family back to Redfern and they started looking for a new place to live. The Housing Commission offered affordable homes in the area, But Yvonne's family was not the only one waiting hopefully for a house.
Some of them got some of them never. We were one of those that never. So we ended up just going house to house. It was a real hard life, you know. Half the time you were looking for a house and the rent would go up, you'd have to get out of that. And then finally I ended up growing up, got married. My husband, he's a real political man, and he fought for that land down there. Oh, not just him, heaps of people.
That land down there that Yvonne is talking about is, of course, the block as we know it today. In 1972, after years of campaigns and protests, the Aboriginal Housing Company secured permanent rights over the terrace houses on the streets of the block. Yvonne and her husband Richard were a newly married couple and they moved into Vine Street.
There's never been a feeling that we had the day we walked into the block to take possession of the houses. You can't explain it. Like the spirit of a living God. He give you this place to go to, and you all stood together as one and just walked into those houses and started a new life where nobody could throw us off. It was a beautiful spirit that was there. I loved it, you know. Yeah, everybody knew everyone. We'd all get out and have a sing-song together at Christmas time. And there were a lot of fights there and things like that. It wasn't a real innocent place, but it wasn't as like everywhere else, you know. You know, you paid your way. You had a house for life, so we thought. But anyway, it was settled. I love that little house.
2 weeks ago, Yvonne and Richard were moved from their place on Vine Street to a terrace house in Waterloo. Yvonne likes the area. It's right near Redfern Oval and the neighbours are friendly. She says she wouldn't want to move back to the block again.
I didn't really want to talk about it anymore because I want to move on now. You can't dwell in the past. I went in there the other day and it's just dead. There's no atmosphere of the peace that was there, the belonging place. Or no joy in it. The spirit's gone from there. It's changed.
Former block resident Yvonne Phillips telling her story of life in Redfern to Madeline James. We now head right into the block for Family and Culture Day, where we meet Yvonne's son, Shane.
My name's Shane Phillips. I live in the block, and this thing here, Family and Culture Day, is about building strength, building strong community, and letting the kids see all the great things that our people are all about. Well, we've had this on the block for the last 2 years, and it's helped us change and save this place, because the block used to, it had a bad period where it represented what was wrong with our people, the drugs, the drug abuse, and it became a place that didn't help our people at all. A few of us live in the houses, and our children had to have somewhere strong to go, and they come home, and the place where they live was, people using heroin around the place and people drinking around the place. It wasn't a place where kids can thrive. And we just got together and said, enough's enough. What are we going to do to make a stand? And we handed out notices saying, be part of the solution and not the problem. And they said, we're going to run a family event once a month for now, but this is what's coming to this community. We had to tell all of our own families, you know, anyone who's using drugs, dealing drugs, you're part of the problem. We can't have it anymore. We've had enough. We walked around, we put the notices under doors, we spoke to people, and then we started the event. And we asked people to come and volunteer their services. All sorts of artists got down here and kept doing it. That has become infectious. What we've seen right now is we know that we've got, you know, people still doing business, but we don't see them no more. We don't see them. And they're not welcome. They're not welcome. If the block can change, a lot of places can change.
You're hearing the sounds of Redfern Station. It's where a lot of people who visit the block alight from the train, cross over the road and head down Everly Street. Here we meet Lionel. He's been a resident of Redfern for over 35 years.
My name's Lionel Pittman, born and raised in Redfern. I'm an artist, sportsman. and Walkabout Man. Grew up in Walker Street, Redfern. I attended the Boys Brigade in George Street. Yeah, I grew up on the block before it all got torn down. There used to be like tin shacks, working people. There's not too many working people there today. But yeah, it was sort of battling, but but you got your food on the table, you know what I mean? I was there when, I think, I'm not sure, was it Malcolm Fraser or Gough Whitlam that opened up the black market for Uncle Tony Munn. Believe you me, the whole block was happy that we had a market for all the people on the block. Or in them days, we call it the Mish, for the Mission. Everybody was over the moon for Uncle Tony. And even when they were short, they'd say, yeah, here, don't worry, just fix it up on payday, you know what I mean? Give them tick, as they say. And then that's when we started putting in another football team. I think they were called the Lewis Street Dodgers, and that was Uncle Mickey and Uncle Tony's team. They were like Canberra Raider colours. So we had Redfern All Blacks, Zetland All Blacks, Lewis Street Dodgers. I played for the Redfern All Blacks, played front rower. That's going back many moons ago. I might as well say it's heritage to me. It's heritage side of the block, Redfern, the Mission. Because my father's worked there. He worked there as a labourer for the block. Same as Tony, Uncle Tony, and his brothers and their kids. Yeah, I'm not into politics or an activist like that, but I love my land, you know what I mean?
A bit further down the street from where Lionel was standing, you come to the Allura Tony Mundine Gym. Anthony Mundine Sr., the Tone Mundine Lionel mentioned, is the owner of this gym. It was built in the 70s, shortly after the Aboriginal Housing Company acquired land for the block. Over the past few years, there have been plans to redevelop the block, which has received a mixed reaction from the community. Just months ago, eviction notices were issued to residents. As part of the block redevelopment plans, the current gym will be knocked down and a new gym built at the top of the block. Jesse Cox went down to meet some of the regulars. Let's go inside.
You enter the gym around the other side of the mural, on the corner of Everly Street and Vine Street. You climb an old staircase covered with boxing posters. And when you get to the top, you realise that the entire place, all the walls, are covered with newspaper clippings, more boxing posters, and these black and white photographs of boxers who used to come and train at the gym. One afternoon, I met Barry Raff. Barry has been coming to the gym pretty much since the beginning, since it opened in the 1970s, and these days trains young, up-and-coming boxers. He took me to a small photo on the wall of when the gym had just opened.
Just one big empty space there, isn't
yeah,
it?
Yeah, that was it.
Has it changed much in those 20 years you've been coming?
It has not changed at all. It was exactly the same. Maybe a few bags have come and gone, but it has not changed, yeah.
One morning at the gym, I met a boxer who described that he thought the charm of the place was that it felt like it was an old boxing gym from the movies. And it kind of does feel like that. It feels almost as if I've stepped into the set of an old Rocky movie. The room is divided in two. On one half is where all the weights machines are, the exercise bikes, and a big space in front of a mirror where the boxers come to warm up before they start fighting. The other half is quite densely packed. It's where all the punching bags are, and also the boxing ring. Most people seem to know each other, and there are also a lot of kids around the gym, mostly Alex's. He's the guy who manages the place. The kids crawl all over the weights, treating it like a giant jungle gym, but the boxers don't seem to mind. There is a really loud beeping in the background. This is a machine that is always on at the gym, and it replicates each 3-minute round in the ring. The gym, like many other buildings on the block, is soon to be demolished as part of the redevelopment. I asked Barry what people thought about the changes.
Most people are pissed, you know, they're very upset about it, but This gym has been a wonderful, it's like a church, mate, you know. I mean, people just come here and do their time here and develop their fitness. It's an interest, it's a hobby, you know.
25 years ago, Barry trained a young boxer by the name of Johnny. Also a promoter, Barry had given Johnny a fight on the undercard of a bout he was putting on at the Canterbury Sports Club. When I first came to the gym, I met Johnny, who had just come back after not fighting for 14 years.
This used to be my life, you know, it was my world. I boxed ever since I was 11 with the old man. And, you know, like, keeps my head above water, just keeps me out of trouble by coming down here and then, you know. And hopefully, you know, after I give up, I might be able to give back and help a couple of the young kids. So, yeah.
And how come you haven't boxed for 14 years?
Due to a drug addiction. Yeah, I lost my old man due to cancer and had a couple of operations. I was addicted to morphine. I got addicted to morphine, you know, during my injuries and things. And next step, I'm using heroin, so... It's been a very, very hard life, you know. Since I stopped fighting, I never had a police record, and I got myself into so much trouble with the coppers, just doing some horrific things that I would not have done unless, if I didn't have an addiction. Because heroin's just like not just a physical addiction, but a very mental addiction as well. So, as I said, you know, this keeps my head above water. Doing my training and, you know, my faith in God is what's got me back here again, I think. Because honestly, mate, I should have been dead 100 times over. So the only addiction I've got at the moment is, mate, I smoke f***ing ciggies, you know what I mean? But if that's the worst things can get, you know, it's not too bad. And my other addiction's here, so...
Johnny is about 6 foot tall. He's got a shaved head. And his body is almost entirely covered with tattoos.
Tells a life story. Yeah, I've got a lot of holy tattoos. My mum's Maltese, so I've got the Maltese cross on the left shoulder. Dad's Irish, so I've got three-leaf clover. I have Hail Mary across the chest, because my mum's name's Mary, and Jesus' mum's name's Mary. And my mum's put up with a hell of a lot since I've been in this addiction, so I do hail my mother Mary, you know.
As well as having Hail Mary tattooed across his chest, Johnny also has St Jude tattooed in his arm.
I've got St Jude on the left arm, patron saint for hopeless and desperate cases.
Johnny's relationship with St Jude started when he was 3. He had an accident where all his tendons in his hand got cut. He was told that he would never move his fingers again, that he would have his hand in a hook for the rest of his life. So his dad went to church, brought back some St Jude oil, poured it on his cast, and according to the story, Johnny started moving his fingers straight away. As well as returning to the gym and getting off heroin, Johnny has also started work as an actor. One of his sponsors, who also spent time behind bars, set up an acting agency called Knockabouts. It specialises in casting extras with a bad boy look. With Johnny's tattoos and boxing history, he was a perfect match and has been on screen a couple of times.
That's given me a lot of inspiration to stay clean as well. It's a lot harder to put your bum on a seat going to a meeting every day than it is to get out there and fight 12 3-minute rounds, you know? I'm in the battle of my life here at the moment trying to stay away from heroin. So, yeah, it's just thank God I'm here again.
Someone poisoned one of their dogs today.
The little fella there and see the star on his trunks? He wasn't a Jew. He was an Aboriginal boxer, but he was a great little puncher. He ended up being a derelict drunk.
Most of the stories that Barry told me about the boxes on the wall also came with a chapter about addiction, either drugs or alcohol. Barry told me that when many boxers finish their career, there is this great void, this sense of emptiness, and that's why many turn to drugs and alcohol as a way of filling it. Then Barry told me that when he was fighting, he also suffered from addiction.
Well, I sort of had a bit of a history with drugs. I had a bit of a drug problem for many years, and I've been clean near 25 years now. But I sort of got into that side of it. And you see, in the boxing game too, a lot of the people that get into it, when the boxing career is finished, there's a void, and you see a lot of them turn to drink or drugs and things like that, and probably the same with me. But I suppose it's like when someone trains to go to war, it builds some character, you know, it builds a... And at the same time, there has to be a deprogramming of that thing. Like I said before, when some people, they live that whole career of being a boxer and things like that, and then when it stops, there's a void, you know. I think people should be aware of that too, to do you have some kind of deprogramming. You hear it about in the Olympics and things like that, and as soon as the career's over, they turn to the bottle or, you know, want to fill the void. Not just boxing, but I think a lot of things can be like that too, eh? You can lose yourself in something and you think this is all it is, and you know, there's more to life, eh? Life is the best left hook. Wouldn't you agree with that, Ray?
What's that, mate?
Life is the best left hook.
Yeah.
Beyond boxing, life.
Yeah.
It sorts us all out.
Barry Raff, trainer in Redfern Gym regular. Barry has been coming to the gym since it first opened in the 70s.
You're listening to All the Best on FBI Radio 94.5, and today's episode we are spending the entire hour in the block. It's some stories we made about a year ago on the program, and since then there's been some changes. All the houses that we are talking about have been demolished, so we thought it was a fitting time to revisit these stories about the people who call the block home.
As you leave the block and head over the train line, you go past the police station, then you come to a strip of shops. This is Redfern Street. This next story is of strength, separation, and losing faith. Gina McEwen takes us up Redfern Street and inside the front gate of the St. Vincent de Paul Catholic Church.
A lot of the community no longer come because they just can't stomach it.
Father Ted led us all to be thinkers and critical thinkers, and suddenly you don't question them at all.
Absolutely buggered it. No sense of cultural reference and significance, but worse, more importantly, just buggered this parish, its traditions and its culture and what it means. We just come in and piss all over it. I think it's good to look at this, what they've done. Let's forget the hyperbole and what it means, what they have done.
Voices of the Catholic community in Redfern. It's where we head next, to the St. Vincent de Paul Catholic Church on Redfern Street. But first, meet Possum.
I come down here when I was 16 and I've been part of Redfern for good... good 32 years.
I first met Possum as I was walking up Redfern Street one day on my way to St. Vincent's Church. While we were talking, he was rolling a cigarette, and I didn't even know if he'd ever been to the church. But as soon as we started talking about it, Father Ted came up.
I met Father Ted, you know, when I was about 18, yeah. You know, he took me into the church, and we all the Aboriginal went, you know, praying all that damn Christians and that. And he was a kind of a man that he'd help you out, you know, if you were down and out. You know, he'd give his time.
St Vincent's Church is up on the main drag in Redfern. It's a red brick and sandstone building that sits neatly between two other buildings. And it's really the kind of place that you'd probably miss if you weren't looking for it. For over 30 years, Father Ted Kennedy was priest here.
Father Ted, he knew a lot of alcoholics, drug addicts, you know, and, you know, domestic relationships and all that, because he'd been there, he'd seen it all, and he was at the heart of things. Sometimes, you know, like I'd, you know, because I had an alcohol problem, I'd go up there and have a yarn with him, and he'd talk to me and, you know, put sense into my head and put me on the right road and that.
Over the 30 years that Father Ted was at Redfern, he became very popular with the local community because he aimed to live and practice the teachings of something called the Second Vatican Council, or Vatican II. So what is Vatican II? In very brief terms, it was established in Rome in the early 60s, and it was about modernising the church to make it more inclusive. So instead of the traditional structure of the priest above the people, the community, regardless of their faith, became the focus of the church. It was now less about sin and being preached to, and more about placing the people's welfare before profit, especially those in need.
He made the services open to everyone. You know, he didn't select, and if people wanted to interact, they interacted.
This is Sister Dom. She's one of the Catholic nuns of Redfern.
You know, he was open. He was ready to listen to everyone. And he learned from everyone.
The idea was Mass was now a community activity involving everyone, which meant the church should no longer intimidate people with all the traditional marble and gold finishings. Apparently Ted had made some pretty drastic changes to the inside of the church to emulate this idea.
Ted would never have the floors covered because he felt that it was closer to the poor. You don't want to keep the poor away.
This is Sister Pat. She's been a part of Redfern Church for 24 years.
Well, Ted certainly brought the altar around. Then the altar used to be that way, with the priest at the back of the people. The whole idea was that we'd be around the altar as equals around the altar.
He did his own way of things, which brought a lot of people into his church. You know, every Sunday the church would be packed with a lot of people, you know, when Father Ted was there. Black, white, you know, all different races. And it was just a happy communal. We all, at the end of the service, have a cup of tea, cup of coffee, have a good yarn. We get to know each other. But now, no people go up there in Hadley to communicate and see each other anymore.
In 2005, Father Ted died after a long illness.
But now he's passed away now, and the church, as it is, it's not the church it used to be when he was there. It all changed.
It's just a negative one, full of guilt and power and authority, and just quite insulting to anybody who does any thinking. It's the difference between a hierarchical domination and relationship. And that's what Vatican II desperately tried to get through. I think he's frightened by this community because they are a very thinking community.
The new priest Sister Pat is talking about is Father Clécio Mendes. He's a priest from Brazil who's been working at the church for a couple of years now. Father Clécio has been labelled as a conservative who's come into a parish that has a long history of being more vernacular.
Father Ted led us all to be thinkers and critical thinkers, and suddenly you don't question them at all. Yeah, I didn't like his image of God.
When Father Clécio arrived at the church, he wasn't happy with what he saw. There was no crucifix behind the altar, the lectern wasn't being used, there were no carpets on the ground, and people used to talk to him during Mass. They'd actually call out to him to talk about issues in the community. This had been something they'd done with Ted. Father Clesio felt there were things that needed to change. I wanted to meet with Father Clesio to talk about what was going on. It did take a lot of convincing to get him to meet with me, as he's still at odds with some of the locals. But after a while, he finally agreed. I met him at the front gate of the church early one afternoon. He's a short guy, wears frameless glasses, and he's very neat and clean-shaven. He has a warm smile, but he was mumbling a little bit and seemed somewhat nervous with me at first. We walked into the church. It was empty and very quiet. I follow him into a small room at the back of the church, which is filled with shelves of soup tins, and then into a smaller room with two chairs. This is the sacristy. We sit down in the chairs, and he tells me about why he thought things needed to change from the way they were with Father Ted.
I really believe he started with very good heart to help the poor. But I think there was a moment he lost control. Because, okay, let us do a revolution. Let's change the things. Let's try to please the people, everyone. It's impossible to please the people. You have 10 people, 10 different ideas. Cannot be like this. The church didn't ask for this.
Even though his accent is heavy, his message is clear. People cannot just pick and choose parts of the religion that suit them. Clesio thinks the way Redfern Church was practicing became too flexible through Vatican II. The church had involved people who weren't Catholic and basically allowed the community to promote their own ideas through the church. He thinks Ted lost control. He tells me about how Father Ted used to give up the presbytery to give homeless people a place to sleep in winter, and this included his own bed. These people had used the presbytery however they liked, according to Clesio, and he thinks this is unacceptable.
If the church become a supermarket, okay, let's please everyone, it's impossible because you're never going to please everyone. Always will come someone and say, no, I don't like this, it's better like this. No. And the church has to say, no, wait a moment. Jesus Christ said, you come follow me, not that I will follow you. If you really want to become a Christian, you have to follow him.
Father Clesio remembers when he first arrived in Redfern, he was told, this is an Aboriginal church, to which he responded, no, this is a Catholic church. Clesio believes the way he's currently running things will save the people of Redfern. He thinks it's a trap for a church to become too relative to its community. If the church just accepts everyone, regardless of faith, it becomes flexible in its practice. It's then likely to neglect instilling the word of God in its people and simply provides them with temporary relief. He says this is what happened with Father Ted. Father Clesio's anguish is that the people of Redfern Church may never find what he calls the real happiness.
Because at the end, you can bring these people, you can make them happy for a while. But they are not, you're not bringing them to the real happiness, that is to find Jesus Christ. Here I don't see fruits of the Holy Spirit, works from God. Here I don't see.
You don't see it in Redfern?
I don't see. If these people are fruit of this Father Ted Kennedy, I don't see the Holy Spirit there.
So one Sunday, I went back to Redfern Church to see for myself what had changed.
In the midst of all the people who would suffer retribution, in the midst of all this, the prophets...
There's about 30 people inside, seated in a space for about 200. The Catholic nuns of Redfern are all sitting together on one side of the altar. Sister Pat, Dom, Mary and Esme. And other people are just scattered in twos and threes across the pews. At the end of the service, Father Clesio made a quick exit to the sacristy after giving me a brief nod and a smile. The mood in the room was pretty tense.
Yeah, hello. Yeah, well, my name is Jack Callaghan and I'm 78 years of age. Still got a bit of life left in me and I've been coming here to Redfern for over 25 years or more.
Jack's got white hair, a steady gaze, and he stands tall. He asked me if I'd like to have a tour of the church. He takes me over to a picture of Father Ted, hanging on the wall behind the altar.
Now, Ted's photo, they wanted us to pull that down. Right? We had a great fight over that. That's bolted to the wall. Okay. And that's not uncommon in Australian churches to have a photograph of long-term pastors.
Then Jack showed me the lectern. And it looked to me like any normal varnished wood lectern. Jack told me Ted had barely used one, but Father Clessier had put it back. It had then disappeared, and Clessier had put in another one. Then that one disappeared, and this kept on happening. Then suddenly something Sister Mary had told me about a little while ago made sense.
The podium. Yeah, the podium, which we tried to get rid of several times, burnt it, but it kept coming back, and then finally they nailed it and drilled it into the... so that it got to be sitting up on a little pedestal.
Yeah, you got rid of it. Did you used to take it out?
Some of the men would take it.
The men...
It made very good firewood for them. Up on the men, people on the block on a cold night.
As I kept walking around the church with Jack, he pointed to a large slab of grey stone, about 1 metre wide and tall, that had been roughly shaped into a square with a basin carved into its top. It had a large pink shell from the Pacific Ocean sitting on it. Jack told me it's the baptismal font. He said the parishioners came into the church one day and found the font dumped up the back amongst the old furniture. It was removed as it was deemed ugly by the new clergy. The baptismal font was eventually put back as it holds great significance for the local Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander communities. Jack kept on showing me more and more things that had changed in the church.
Absolutely buggered. No sense of cultural reference or significance, but worse, more importantly, just bugger this parish, its traditions and its culture and what it means. We just come in and piss all over it. I think it's good to look at these, what they've done. Let's forget the hyperbole and what it means, what they have done.
Father Clessier finds it sad that the community don't understand what he's doing. He finds strength in the idea that he is saving the people of Redfern. Being that he thinks it's a trap for a parish to try to satisfy the many needs of its community, he must first instill the Word of God. This, he believes, will bring real relief to those in need. I had only visited this church for Mass once or twice, both times when Clessier was there, so I wondered how many people from Ted's time still came. So you just don't still go anymore?
No. When Father Ted left, he just left a massive hole that can't be filled by him. And I don't think this new preacher really understands, you know.
A lot of the community no longer come because they just can't stomach it. It's not a nice word to use. And we go. It's not an enjoyable experience. But you go to support the community, the ones who do come.
You still go on a Sunday.
We support each other. Yes.
I think our role in Redfern is to allow people to be themselves. To be themselves, to find their own pace of life, their own rhythm in life. And in that way, they will, if their head and their heart are together, they will be united with God, with the Spirit or whatever. I don't think Catholicism has anything to do with it. I'd probably be sacked.
One would think that the church should be able to relate to its community.
Well, if it doesn't, what's it doing there? Ask me, what's it doing there?
Thank you.
Gina McEwen speaking with Sister Dom, a Catholic nun of Redfern. You're on All the Best on FBI. My name's Eliza Silos, and as we walk out onto Redfern Street again, we meet Mahalia and make our way back down to the block.
Hi, my name's Mahalia. I've lived on and off on the block for about nearly 30 years on and off. Yeah, so I was only about 3 or 4 years of age when I come there, and grew up there, and about 7 or 8 we moved out the western suburbs and come back in, back and forwards. Other relatives still lived in Redfern all their lives, and yeah, it's like a meeting place, like where they all come from the country and they all come there to Redfern and meet up with all their families and that, and gathering, and so yeah, sort of like a bit of an experience here. Oh, it's great in the block when I was young. Everyone, all family around, they all looked after each other. Everyone, you know, just doesn't matter whose family it was, they all just took in other people's kids and looked after them and sort of all stuck together and that. So, yeah, I sort of basically left sort of when the drugs sort of came into it and that. So I sort of didn't experience much here with the drugs. But, yeah, it's, yeah. Just a lot of change heaps when all the younger generation now using heroin and everything like that, and the block just got a lot of people coming to the block and using heroin and ODs and stuff like that, and it just went downhill. But before, many years ago, it was really, really good. All the people, all the old elders that we all knew have all passed on now and that, and it's all new generation now, and it's not the same like it was many years ago with this new generation here now, but the older generation would all try and keep all the family together and that. Yeah, so it's all just changed now, it's not the same. I've had a pretty good time growing up here and that sort of thing, yeah. But it's a shame that the block's gone now. That's sort of like home, you know, I miss it sort of thing. It's not the same anymore. Yeah. We still sort of all come and meet around somewhere, but not down the block anymore, it's not the same, but we all still sort of gather up around the street here. Miss it anyway, but I suppose you've got to move on in life anyway, but yeah, there's nothing we can really do anyway now, so yeah, just only memories now. Yeah, so
The block was the first urban land rights claim, so ideas of ownership are particularly loaded with political and cultural significance. The community is divided between those who support the redevelopment and some who disagree with parts of the project. In our next piece, we hear from Aboriginal Housing Company CEO Michael Mundine, who has been instrumental with the redevelopment plans.
Well, see, people got to realise too, like, the land belongs to the Aboriginal Housing Company Limited, right? And we have got 100 members. Now, the members are the shareholders. They're the only one got the right to voice their opinion with this community, not every individual Aboriginal people. And I think where we had the problem in the past, that because it's Aboriginal Housing Company, Aboriginal land, every individual people, don't care where they are, coming and think they got a say in this community. Really, it's like any organisation, any company. Members got the right to say and what to do in their own community.
Michael Mundine, or Mick Mundine as he is known around the block, has worked for the Aboriginal Housing Company since 1975 and became CEO in 1983. For a lot of that time, he has held a grand vision for the area.
I mean, my family said, Mickey, get out of us 10, 15 years ago. You're never going to do it. But I believe that, you know, you've got a destiny in life. And I believe the Lord put you in that position. And if it's my destiny to come here and do what I'm doing, well, man, you know, I believe the script had been written for this community years ago.
Mick talks about seeing the block blossom in the 80s as a caring and sharing community. He also talks of the devastating effect drugs and alcohol had on the community in the 90s.
Our block, the block, it became the Black Flag graveyard. You know, like you know about the Hillifin graveyard. They go home to die. This is how this place was becoming, where people are dying, ODing, you know, people getting shot, people getting murdered here. We cannot let it happen no more. And we had to stand up at the Aboriginal people and say, no more. We can't let our people suffer.
Mick has developed a new plan to build a new community, including 62 houses, a new gym, an art gallery and cultural centre, as well as a retail precinct. But to do that, most of the existing block would have to be demolished.
Well, the demolition started last week. Out of 14 people, got 3 left to be relocated. That'll happen in due time. Like, we're not going to put no pressure. We'll make sure that every individual tenant get a good affordable housing outside this area.
The most contentious part of this proposal is deciding who will come back to the new houses. Mick is talking about the relocation that has been happening. The families currently living in the block are being moved into new housing, mainly around Waterloo. But not all are guaranteed a return to the new community.
It's all depend on their tenant's history. If you've been a good tenant, and not detrimental to this organisation, you know, automatically you'll come back. But if you've done the wrong thing by the company, or known to be a drug seller, or drug house, you know, I think in their own heart of mind, they shouldn't even think of coming back here.
And it is this that has attracted most of the media attention. When you interview Mick, he's feisty, passionate, and ready to rebut any concern you may have. He's sure that this is the right thing to do.
Though I said to a couple other media people, I said, look, this privilege is with an individual people. Okay, we might be knocking down, we'll be knocking down brick and mortar. Change the community, but the true spirit and soul, the soul, heart and soul, is an individual people. They bring that back here. It's never going to change. It's really up to the individual people, human people, themselves, to make sure that the spirit never changes. And you know, you can knock down a building. That's not, it's not a human being. It's only just brick and mortar. But it's just within individual people. They carry on that heart and soul.
In our program today, we've heard stories from people who have an incredibly strong connection to Redfern and the block. It's hard to see some of these places as just brick and mortar. The success or failure of the block's redevelopment will ultimately be the legacy Mick Mundine leaves the community. Whether that's a legacy the community wants or will be thankful for is hard to know.
A lot of people like changes. And because the changes are happening, you think, oh, wait, is he doing the right thing? You sure you're not ripping us off? You sure you're not selling the block? See, a lot of people think we're selling the block. A lot of people think our developer's moving and taking another block. That's all crap. This block will never be sold. It's by our constitution. The block will never be sold because, you see, for our people to build good, affordable housing on it. It'll never be sold, but you tell them people out there, like talking to this wall. Seriously, you know? Don't care whatever you say. So until people visualise things, they sort of don't believe. Like you take when we knock in the first lot of houses in Eberly Street, or Lewis Street of the first lot, and they say, oh, they're going to jump in front of the bulldozer, they do this, do that. And then, but when we knock them down and lay the turf, then they say, oh, gee, that's nice. So, you know, maybe it's people in general. You know, people sometimes they don't believe or want to believe until they visualise something happening or they see it in writing. That's maybe just life, I don't know.
Mick Mundine, CEO of the Aboriginal Housing Company. He's heading up the redevelopment of the block. To end our show today, we walk just around the corner from the Aboriginal Housing Company to Caroline Street. Two of the Catholic nuns of Redfern still live here, as they have done for years, in a small two-storey terrace called Gathering Place. We stand with Sister Mary looking out over Chippendale toward the city, with the Aboriginal flag mural in front of us at the bottom of the hill. The demolition has already started happening.
Yeah, there used to be houses all down here. See, they're all being demolished now. The people are gone. The meeting place is gone. That's what you miss most. Yeah, they'd be all around here. They'd be sitting everywhere. Groups of them all over the place. In the new plans that they showed us, they've got a meeting place, like a meeting room, or I suppose a place where they could meet. God help us, they don't want to meet inside. But it's way down there, that end of the and they don't want to be down there, they want to be up here because this is where people arrive from.
Yeah.
Hi, Bruce.
Hi,
Mum. Morning. Yeah, people arrive, say, by train, or they come that way. And so that's why they sit in these places, because they see them when they first arrive. Oh, bugger all. But isn't it not interesting to see the growth coming out of the middle of the flag down there? See the grass growing from the from the crack there in the wall, or the, some little shrub or whatever, I see it. So something will happen. It's a sign of life, isn't it? Life will go on.
Today's show was produced by Gina McKeon, with contributions from Kathleen, Madeline James, Eliza Silos, and myself. The original technical producer was Sheila Shanton. The technical producer for this compile repeat was Antonia Gauci. Sound supervision on All the Best by Q. The show is produced by Eliza Silos and executive producers Bridget Dagg and myself, Jesse Cox. Next week, Eliza Silos will be back to bring you three new stories all about reinvention. All the Best is produced at FBI Radio Sydney, distributed via the Community Radio Network all across Australia and supported by the Community Broadcasting Foundation. Until next week, make sure you keep in touch with all things All the Best. Just head to fbiradio.com. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter.
I'm going to leave you now with a track from The Last Connection, who are regulars down at Family and Culture Day at The Block. This one is called Balura Man. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you again next week where we explore the theme of change here on All the Best.
Even sure if I thought, if my thought, I'm hearing voices. What's worse, I listen to.